Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, April the 12th. As we like to do once a week, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, and take a look at some of the issues of the last week and some of the stories that may be happening this week. Lots of stuff going on, so let's get to our friend Bill as soon as possible. I want to make sure we cover everything. Bill, how's the weather in New York? I always ask you that.
Weather is actually very, very good.
I intend
to go outside. I now have my two shots, so I will carry my shot card with me, my papers, so that the Al Gore group downstairs does not stop me. And I intend to have a very nice day. New York is politically is in a different situation. The mayor of New York announced yesterday a commission to combat racism that he has formed,
and to
go back to the beginnings of our national shame, he said. Now, the mayor, this is an odd thing for the mayor to do because he's leaving office at the end of this year, so I have no idea why he waited this long in two terms to start this commission up. I guess he's satisfying his base.
Right. Maybe he thought that everything was perfect for the first 7 years of his term, but now that he's going away, he has to leave his signatures everywhere, Bill.
Well, he I think he would like to. You know, one of the things that came out in the last week that is not being widely reported, the level of the press being what it is that 95% of the shooting victims in New York these days, 95% are African American.
Wow.
And I think that the
of the victims, you're saying. You're saying the victims, right? I wonder who shoots the gun. I wonder if they have a demographic on that.
That's a sensitive issue, and the story I read did not point that out. But you can be sure that overwhelmingly it is people within the same community.
Yes,
this is a catastrophe for Black America. We talk about we talk about great national crises and health crises. We are told now that racism is a health crisis. But what about the killings each week of African American children who will not get to live to be 18? I think that's a health crisis. That's a real health crisis. But that's the one nobody wants to talk about. But I know that there is deep, deep frustration within the Black community, especially among women, you know, who are demanding some kind of action to end this horror. But the political class doesn't seem all that interested.
No, they're not, and it doesn't fit the narrative, as someone said. But you know, it is amazing because there's a story breaking as we came on the air today out of Minneapolis. Apparently, they've had to call the National Guard in Minneapolis again because they're having more problems. And you know, I don't know much about the story other than the headline, but apparently, the police shot somebody in Minneapolis. Go ahead and tell us, please.
The police fatally shot a man, black man, who was trying to run away from them. They had stopped him in what looked like an ordinary traffic stop. They realized that he had, once they did the check, that he had an outstanding arrest warrant. They told him, do not leave the car, do not try to run away. Well, he did. He put his foot on the gas. He tried to escape. And for some reason, they shot. Now, if they shot under those circumstances, the police, and only those circumstances, that's pretty bad procedure because they could pick them up somewhere else. But we don't know what the actual circumstances are. They must have shot possibly for another reason. And the result of the shooting, of course, was that the defendant or the individual is dead, and there are now demonstrations in the city of Minneapolis. The National Guard has been called out. The governor fanned the flames by his description of the event. The governor is a very left-wing governor. And there we are once again. And this is coming in the middle of the trial
of the
police officer who allegedly killed George Floyd. And there is the possibility that the jury will be contaminated because they'll hear about this. So we don't know what the situation will be.
Yeah, we don't know. And again, we want to get more information. As I've said before on our program that, you know, I like to give – I don't defend the police unconditionally because they make mistakes like anybody else. But I do feel, Bill, that in many of these large cities, we're putting the police in an almost impossible situation. And I don't, you know, I don't know why these policemen just don't walk out and say, you know, you want us to protect the city, you want us to be here to fight crime, and then every time something happens, we're automatically guilty, and you have politicians like the governor of Minnesota say things that, you know, as my father used to say, do not help the situation, Bill.
That's exactly right. And the police have the feeling here in New York, certainly, where you have a leftist Marxist mayor in New York City and a governor who I don't know if you could describe him politically in trouble. In trouble is probably the best you can do. And they don't have the backs of the police. Mm-hmm. They really don't. And the police feel it. I believe the force is losing people. I think in many cities the police forces are losing people. But that, of course, is exactly what the far left wants. They want a society without police. And for some reason, they believe it'll be a better society. I don't know what happens when there's an emergency, but they believe it'll be a better society.
Well, they'll call the social justice warriors then to, you know, to deal with the problem, I guess. You know, the social justice warrior will keep the guy with the gun away, Bill.
Well, that's it. And we just had a situation in Portland, which has seen night after night of violence, where the mayor tried to reverse previous anti-police mechanisms that were put in place, and the city council, which is very far left, refused. They refused to increase the budgeting for the police, even though the city is in desperate trouble. I don't know where a city like that goes. They are going to put in to Portland, as part of a new proposal that has passed the city council, the equivalent of park rangers, unarmed people who will rush to an emergency. And this is madness. First of all, who would want that job? Who would want to be an unarmed, in effect, park ranger who would be expected to intervene in a violent situation? I dread the occurrence of the first casualty among this group. And even the one of the police union officials said, where are you going to get people? They're already so thin. This is a situation where you have ideology over common sense and ideology over public service. These individuals who run these cities, who run the city council, don't care about results. What they care about is the ideology. The ideology says get rid of the police or you get rid of the police.
You just wonder, Bill, I'm just thinking out loud, but you wonder, there's already all kinds of movements in states like Oregon and Washington, and I understand Illinois as well. Well, the people who live outside of these cities are saying, we're paying for all this garbage, and we don't even relate to these people. I mean, because defunding the police is probably popular in Seattle, but not in the rest of the state, I guarantee you. And so I just wonder how much longer, one of these states simply say, we want out of this, or we're not going to pay taxes any longer in protest for this. I mean, it cannot be a healthy situation, Bill.
It can't be. Now, the situation in Minneapolis, we are saying Minneapolis, actually the action occurred in a suburb of Minneapolis, I think a close-in suburb. But you mentioned the defunding the police proposals. I think that they are not even popular any longer among most Democrats. I think people are seeing the light of day that you have to have an effective and well-trained police force. No one denies that there are incidents that should not happen. But what is remarkable in terms of relationship, I'm speaking now about New York City, about the relationship between minorities and the police, is how basically good it is. The police have worked for years to improve that situation. They have succeeded. When people say defund the police in New York, I don't think they get much attention, although I've heard it from very young people who get taught this in school and the propagandistic schools that we're developing. But we are approaching situations in many of these cities that remind us of the 1960s. Where you had rioting in cities, where you had very high crime rates. For some reason, some people on the political left seem to like high crime rates. I don't know what their mentality is, but I would imagine it would go something like this. High crime rates simply prove to us the discontent of the minorities, and that proves our point. And that's the way these people think. It's terrible.
It's terrible. Now, the other day, you may have heard this, on this subject, the other day, Charles Barkley, the former NBA player who does, I guess, analysis on TV, although I have to confess I haven't seen NBA games in a while, so I don't know what games he's doing these days. But Charles Barkley, I read, said something that he said, most people are good, but there are elements who want us to hate each other. I'm paraphrasing what he said, but I think he's exactly right. I think if you took – the other day I was watching something – on one of these webcasts where they were interviewing black people in, I think, Georgia, and they were saying, do you believe that ID, voter ID is important? And the lady said, well, you need an ID to do everything else. What's wrong with that? And I just feel that there's a disconnect between these people who run our cities and even the people they're governing, Bill. I just feel like there's a huge disconnect there. When does that end? When does it stop? I don't know, but it's evident to me, Bill, and I'm looking from the outside, it's evident to me that the people running these cities, a lot of these activists, and the people suffering the crime like in New York, they're living in different planets, so I don't know how much longer it can continue, Bill.
I think you're absolutely right. I think increasingly you have a situation that resembles the old political machines in large cities, where the machines really were in business for themselves, and they did not represent or even particularly care that much about the needs of the people. We make an assumption that if a particular group, in this case African Americans, elects its own leaders, that those leaders care about the people who elected them. They may not. They may care only about their own advancement and the advancement of an ideology. I think you have, as you made the point about defunding the police and about voter ID, every single public opinion poll that I've seen shows that the overwhelming majority of African Americans favors voter ID. Voter ID is used throughout the world. It's used throughout the democracies of Africa. As the lady you quoted mentioned, we use it all over society. You have to have ID sometimes simply to buy a baseball ticket. You have to have ID
to pick
beer.
Up tickets. If you go to the, I mean, if you buy the ticket online and you have to go to the park to pick it up, yeah, you need an ID for that. You're exactly right.
And also the fact that the great majority of African Americans want clean elections. And one of the purposes of voter ID is not to suppress their vote, but to make certain that the votes of illegal voters are suppressed. And there is I don't know of any group in society that I've seen identified that in a poll is against voter ID. But who is against voter ID? The left-wing political leadership, which usually includes the black political leadership. And you wonder why they would be against voter ID. Now, Stacey Abrams in Georgia says she is against voter ID because it is hard for black people to get voter ID, and therefore it's a voter suppression measure. It is not hard for black people to get voter ID, especially in Georgia, which makes it easy. Everybody else does it, and African Americans usually have the same ID in their wallets as everybody else. They have driver's licenses, they have records of bank accounts, they have other kinds of ID, it is just a ridiculous situation. I see yesterday that there are corporate types trying to pressure corporations into making public statements against voter ID. Why they would do this, I don't know. I don't understand the role of these corporations unless they are being shaken down.
Yeah. Well, that is probably what's happening, because we had a similar situation here in Texas where the Texas Senate passed a law that simply redefined how you vote in Texas. They simply said, look, there's three ways of voting. You can vote in person, you can vote by absentee, or you can vote early. It's been that way ever since I've lived in Texas, pretty much. And then you have these activists going on TV saying, well, they're taking away our right to vote by drive-in. And they never had that right. That's something that some Democrats in Harris County, which is Houston, came up with last year, and it was immediately shut down by the court saying, we don't do that in Texas. We don't mail votes or ballots, and then people can take them to somebody picking them up, like if you were, you know, making deposits at a drive-in bank or something. We never had that right. But yet, but now they're saying that right was taken away. But they never had that right. And what amazes me is the number of corporations who play along with this. These companies better understand that people are not just voters, they're also consumers. And I think there's going to be a backlash. I mean, I hate to say it, I love Major League Baseball, but I think the commissioner of Major League Baseball has put the league or the business of baseball in a terrible situation. Somebody wrote an article the other day saying that the owners should fire the commissioner and at least do whatever they can to protect their bottom line, because this is going to go against their bottom line, Bill.
Well, it will. I'm very much looking forward to seeing seeing what they do on the day of the All-Star game, whether or not the television ratings go down. Television is, of course, the place where they get most of their money from. And I think that there should be a national campaign to say, just turn off your sets. And maybe people will. And if ratings from last year go down 50, 60%, they may or may not get the message, but I suspect they will get the message.
Well, it's a business. That's what people forget. I mean, it's a sport. Yes, of course it's a sport. But it's a business. And these owners, I mean, that's why they have these teams, to make money. And if you take a hit, it's going to hurt. But the other thing, too, talking about baseball, that makes no sense to me about what the commissioner did is you don't put together an All-Star game in 6 months. I mean, the game's going to be played in 3 months, actually. And the city of Denver is not ready for this. It takes years for these cities to get ready for an All-Star game, because you got to have all kinds of stuff that you do, businesses and promotions and all of that, and so this could be a disaster in Denver, not because of Denver's fault, just because they didn't have time to put it together. So I don't know. I think it's going to be a real problem for Major League Baseball. I have not met a single baseball fan who actually supports the decision, Bill. I really haven't.
No.
Maybe I don't have the most diverse group of friends, but everybody I know says they don't like it. And I saw a statistic, I think Rasmussen was saying, that most Americans don't like it either, Bill.
Well, I suspect that's true. But, you know, we go back to the 1960s when Richard Nixon coined the term the silent majority. And it turned out he was basically correct. Most people do not like wokeism. Most people do not like cancel culture. And I think they wish it would go away, but also most people are not that active politically, or may even be afraid to be active politically. We have plenty of reports of parents of school children who are horrified by what their children are being taught, and yet they're afraid to speak out because the schools have so much control over their children.
Yeah. Now, we'll take a break in a second here, but I think those parents, Bill, may very well have the ultimate say, because you're seeing, you know, I just saw a statistic that 11% of American children are now homeschooled, which is an astonishing number. I mean, it surprised me so much. I had to check it twice, you know, but that's one out of every 10 kids who's at home.
Yes.
Getting an education. Now, I don't know what it 10 years ago, but I don't think it was anywhere near that 10 years ago. I'm pretty sure of that. And you have more and more movements toward, you know, the school choice So, you know, yes. So eventually it may all work out on behalf of the parents, but it is frustrating, and no question about it, what we're going through. Let me take a break, Bill, and then we'll come back
okay. And
we'll get into a lot of the stuff that is in the news today, including Taiwan and China. We're going to talk a little bit about that because that could be the big story of 2021. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, talking with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I just wanted to take a very quick detour, Bill, from the topics and remember April 12th. Two big things happened on April 12th in American history. The Civil War began, or at least the first shots, in 1861. And then, of course, more recently, the passing of President Roosevelt and the incoming President Truman. So, you know, two big things in American history that were very consequential, to say the least, Bill.
Well, yes, and, dates are important. Dates are important, and I think they remain important in our lives if we actually experienced an event. I am old enough to remember President Roosevelt's death, and I remember sitting in I guess it was the kitchen with my mother. I was just a little kid. And the phone rang, and it was her brother, and it was informing her that President Roosevelt had died. And I remember very specifically my mother saying, "Al, I feel as if my fingers just fell off." And that's the way people fell. They couldn't imagine the country without Franklin Roosevelt, whether they liked him or not. He had been president since 1933, the longest run of any American president. And it was 1945, 12 years later. He was the president. For many young people, young adults, he was the only president they ever knew. And with his death came a void. The man who was vice president had just become vice president. Harry S. Truman had been a senator from Missouri, a well-known senator, to be sure. But he had taken office with Mr. Roosevelt on January 20th at the inauguration. He was only in office a few months, and now he was president of the United States. And Americans were very, very concerned. What kind of a man is this? Can he do the job? The world situation was in our favor. We were winning World War II decisively. Indeed, one of the sadnesses of the time of his death is that Franklin Roosevelt, who guided us through World War II, did not live to see the end of the war and to see the German surrender, which would have come less than a month later, and the Japanese surrender, which would have come during the summer. It was President Truman who presided over those. So April 12th means a lot to me. It means a lot to people in my generation and, of course, to the older generation, because it was the day when our leadership changed so decisively. Fortunately, the wise men in Washington who had picked Harry Truman to be on the ticket in 1944 as vice president, because the vice president of the United States during World War II was Henry Wallace. And Henry Wallace was a decent man, but was seen by the Washington establishment as too far to the left to be president. He was really a progressive. He was removed from the ticket in 1944, replaced by Harry Truman. And Harry Truman went on to be a president who fought back against unpopularity to win the 1948 presidential election, his victory unexpected, and to be seen today as one of America's great or near great presidents.
Yeah, very consequential man, to say the least, Harry Truman. And I just, you know, I think it must have been quite a shock that day, like your mom.
You're
relating the story of your mom. It had to be a shock for most Americans to get that telephone call like your mom did, or to hear about it, like I guess most people did on the radio or however.
Yes.
So a very important day, to say the least. You know, and with the passing of my friend Bob Jaggers the other day, this is the question, of course, that we asked. Remember, you asked him that question when we did that show with him back in 2014. You asked him that question. He said, President Roosevelt was probably the only president you had ever known. Well,
that's
he was
right.
Born in 1922, so you're exactly right. I mean, because he was 11 when FDR became president, and he was a young man in the Navy when he died. So you're right. That was the only president that he had ever known. So, you know, quite a day in American history. April 12th, the Civil War began, and the passing of FDR and the coming of President Truman. Well, I mentioned before we went on the break, Bill, that I want to talk about China and Taiwan, because I have this funny feeling that this is an issue we're going to revisit several times. I think the Chinese want to go into Taiwan. I'm pretty convinced of that now. And I think they're going to do it. When they do it, I don't know, of course. But they may be looking for the right time. And I have to confess that President Biden may be helping them with his weakness finding that time, Bill. And I don't know how President Biden would react. I'm sitting here, you know, I think I know how President Trump would have reacted. President Trump would have made it very clear to the Chinese, don't do it, or there will be serious consequences. Maybe President Biden would do the same thing, but they may not fear him, Bill.
That's the point. Wars often begin with miscalculations. We know that the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor took place despite the fact that the very admiral who planned the attack pleaded with his government not to do it. He said, I know the Americans. I've studied in the United States. The Japanese government came to the conclusion that the Americans weren't going to fight back, that they would go for a political settlement. And the Admiral Yamamoto, who planned the attack, said, no, they will fight back. I know them. And he said, famously, I can give you 6 months of running free around the Pacific, but I can't give you more than that. And 6 months to the week after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States won the Battle of Midway, and from that point forward, it was an American war. Admiral Yamamoto was right in arguing against the misunderstanding of the United States. We believe, at least many intelligence people believe, that Osama bin Laden completely misunderstood the United States when he ordered the attacks of September 11th, 2001. He believed the United States would not fight back. And he was wrong. He was very wrong. Mm-hmm. They have these beliefs based on the attention we give our military, on the statements of public officials, and what they perceive to be the mood of the American people. Now, if you were a diplomat in Washington, a Chinese diplomat, and you were sending back dispatches every day on the condition of the United States, you might very well come to the conclusion that the United States is a weak, divided nation, and that the American people would not allow a military response to something that happens way out in the Western Pacific that doesn't concern them. And, of course, that could be a correct interpretation depending on who was in the White House. But I fear a miscalculation that could go either way. It could go that it is a complete miscalculation and they try to take Taiwan and fight bitterly against the Taiwanese but win, in which case we will be completely humiliated as a nation and will lose great influence in the Western Pacific, or we might fight back. I think Biden has the capacity within him to order military action in some form of retaliation against China. I don't know if Kamala Harris would if she were president. At any rate, it might come too late, too little, too late, and we would lose anyway. The Pentagon has run military problems, exercises, to determine what would happen in the event of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And if I am correct in interpreting them, the indications are that we would lose, at least under current situations and current levels of strength. What Biden is willing to do in the meantime to build up, it's hard to say. He proposed a military budget last month that actually, to my surprise and my pleasant surprise, showed an increase in allocations for the military, but he immediately got attacked by the left wing of his party, and I'm not so sure that that budget is going to pass Congress. So here again, we're in a situation where the diplomats looking at the United States will have to make an interpretation as to what the mood of the American people is. The reauthorization of the Draft Act in 1941 passed the House of Representatives by one vote, and you may be sure that the Japanese looked at that as part of their justification for an attack on Pearl Harbor, saying this is a country that is so divided it will never fight.
And it kind of reminds, it reminds me a little bit of Gaddafi in 2003 when he gave up his WMDs because he knew that Bush would take him out if he had to. And that's the kind of fear that I don't see with Biden. I could be wrong. I mean, we could be in a huge war and defeat the Chinese. I don't know, but it would come at a very heavy price even if we win,
yes.
Bill. And the question I ask is, I mean, you go to the American people and you say, okay, well, you know, we're sending the Marines in to protect Taiwan. First of all, we don't even recognize Taiwan as a nation anymore, right? Didn't that happen? That Taiwan is not, we don't even have diplomatic relations or a defense treaty with it anymore, do we, Bill? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what our formal status is. I do think we give them aid of one kind or another. But I let's see. I'm gonna go to my computer. The United States recognize Taiwan? And I should have been ready with the answer to that. The United States is Taiwan's strongest partner, despite not officially recognizing it, having broken off relations with Taiwan in 1979 for diplomatic ties with China.
Right. That's what I remember, that we had broken diplomatic relations when President Carter established diplomatic relations with China. But from what I can tell, Taiwan is not going to be an easy adversary. I mean, they may lose, but they're going to put up one heck of a fight. Either way, this is a bad situation for the United States because, you know, we're going to be totally involved in that region one way or the other if the Chinese go in. And I do believe, I don't have any evidence, but I do believe the Chinese are closer to going in now than they've ever been before, Bill.
That is probably true. If you were a Chinese general in Beijing today looking at the United States, you might advise the president of China, this is the time to strike. They are not in a position to fight back, and they have a Congress controlled by a political party that is pro-China in many respects, that would not tolerate a war against China. The American people are exhausted from the pandemic and from years of stationing troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and seeing those troops fight and die. Good time to do it. And this is what I'm afraid of, too. I really think it could happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I hope it doesn't happen. I hope I'm wrong. And I hope that China does not invade Taiwan. But I feel, I don't know, I feel that this is the time for them to do it because, all the... If I was a Chinese general and the president of China would ask me, do we do it now? I think he would say, this is a good opportunity. I mean, you don't even have to win the war. All you have to do is take over Taiwan or at least invade Taiwan and take over Taiwan. And that would be a huge victory. And that would really be bad for the United States because what happens with South Korea? What happens with Japan? Australia, New Zealand, all of a sudden those countries would look at that and say, wait a minute, are they going to help us if we need help? That's the other
issue. That's right. And that is the point. We would never be taken seriously again as a Western Pacific power. And that decision by other countries not to take us seriously would have enormous implications because who would they take seriously? Well, China. And they would cozy up more to China than they are today. It could have enormous economic implications for the United States. It could result in the loss of jobs here, in the loss of economic opportunities in China here. It could have effects in other parts of the world because our NATO allies looking at that debacle that would be implied in the loss of Taiwan could say, well, what would happen to us if war broke out? The United States is under a weak administration. Trump is no longer president. They would suddenly miss President Trump.
That's
for sure. You know,
I think a lot of people are going to miss. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Go ahead and finish, please.
No, I said there'd be signs up, you know, bring back the obscene guy, you know?
Yeah, bring back the guy we used to hate so much, because at least he defended us when times got tough. Yeah, I have a feeling that a lot of people are going to miss Trump over the next 12 months. I not necessarily miss his tweets or his personality, but they're going to miss his presidency, Bill. Well, I want to bring up another topic, and this is, of course, a big topic down here in Texas, but it's becoming in the country as well, and that's the U.S.-Mexico border. And I guess the question, Bill, I would ask you, maybe you can tell us, have you seen Kamala Harris lately? Have you seen the vice president lately? We haven't seen her down here, and she's supposed to be running, overseeing this border crisis, Bill.
The last time I saw Kamala Harris, she was on a milk carton. And is listed as a missing person, and you can call a number and report her. I mean, I have never seen a situation like this. The vice presidency is an office we often laugh at because it is, as Nelson Rockefeller said, standby equipment. You sit around waiting for the president to die, and you get practice by going to funerals in foreign nations. But the fact is the president has assigned her to something involving the border, and she doesn't go. I have a feeling it's quite intentional. This is pure speculation on my part. I don't think she wants to go.
Right.
I don't think she wants to get involved in that issue. I think she realizes there's a good chance she will be president before too long because of the president's obvious decline in health. And she wants to start fresh. Now, she knows if she goes to the border, she will have to answer questions about what she sees there. And I can't imagine that this is a welcome assignment for anybody. At the same time, the crisis at the border builds and builds and builds. We are letting into this country people we don't know, people who may not wish us well. We are also letting in people who may take the jobs of Americans. It is just a terrible situation, and one that is entirely the doing of President Biden. This was not the situation on January 20th of this year when the administrations changed.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. And I know that Governor Abbott of Texas has been sending her letters asking her to come down or at least talk to her about the problems. The governor of Arizona has apparently done the same thing, and it's like, you know, you begin to wonder, maybe she just found out about it. You know, she was standing behind him one day, and he said, well, the vice president is going to be in charge of this, and she goes, me? Well, you didn't tell me anything.
Yes.
And so maybe you get the feeling, but I think you are right. I think she doesn't want to mess with it. I think she's smart enough to know that this is a no-win situation. I mean, what exactly is she going to do? Coming down here and say, well, gee, you know, we're being humane now. Okay?
Yes. Yeah. That is probably the point. I think she's probably getting advice, just don't get involved and for it. And, you know, she's kind of a small-time politician. You don't think of Kamala Harris as working on the world stage. They tell us that she talks to foreign leaders. I wonder sometimes if she talks to the leaders or to a voice double who they put in just to talk to Kamala Harris. Your job today, Jose, is to talk to Kamala Harris.
Right, right.
It is embarrassing. It is embarrassing to us as a country. This is a true crisis. It requires leadership. We're not getting the leadership. And the person who is being made the point woman, Kamala Harris, does not seem to want to provide leadership or even to discuss the issue or any other issue for that matter.
No, I mean, you don't see much of the lady. Now, like you were saying before, vice presidents do tend to be in the background. So maybe that's just what we're seeing here. But if the president says she's going to be overseeing this and for 18 days or 19 days, she hasn't even held a press conference to talk about this. You have to wonder what's going on in this White House, because we're not going to get any leaks out of this White House. We're not going to get these people close to the information who are going to tell us what's going on like we did under Trump. But I have a feeling that maybe they don't even talk to each other, Bill, the president and the vice president. They just they tell the vice president, well, at 11 o'clock today, the president is going to speak. We need you here. We'll send the car for you. You kind of get the feeling that's the way it is, Bill.
Well, yes, you don't get any notion of a team or a coherent government or a cabinet that is fully involved. The director of Homeland Security has been to the border several times. I don't think he's held any serious press conferences about it. I think we are short of the American people being completely obsessed with it. I think there's obvious concern, and Americans do not want illegal immigration to continue, but they're not getting hysterical about it. I think that one calculation the administration is making is that the economy will improve dramatically by next year, and that the Democratic Party will retain control of both houses of Congress. That could happen. There's nothing better in politics than sending checks to the voters. I mean, they respond. They got a relief check because of the virus, a relief check that most probably didn't even need, but they respond positively. Buying votes is an American tradition, time-honored American tradition. There should be a statue in Washington to the first vote buyer, whoever he was. But they won't tear that statue down. You know, that's basically the way the system works. So I think there may be some calculation in this. There was an article over the weekend in one of the conservative journals asking, is Joe Biden a better politician than we think? And it's mm-hmm. possible. Remember, the man survived for how many years? 47 years
right.
in Delaware, getting reelected and reelected and reelected. He does have that knack. And I think that taking over the houses of Congress next year may be harder than Republicans think.
Yeah, it could all be true. I mean, but what's interesting, though, is that if you look at the – and I don't want to focus exclusively on the Rasmussen poll, but that's just the one that I think has been most reliable. He's only at 50%, but 50%, as we know, is enough to reelect him if the election were held today. So you may be right. Maybe he's smarter than we think he is.
I think he may be. Also, we should point out that the Rasmussen poll tends to tilt slightly Republican. The president is at a higher point in other polls, the more traditional polls, and I would imagine his popularity is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 52-53%. While that's not a huge popularity, it is, as you say, enough to get him reelected and maybe enough to bring in members of Congress next year. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see.
They are determined.
The question I have about the economy, Bill, and you may be 100% right that the economy helps them, but I also think that a lot of people, it seems like the country is so divided. Half of the country is going to say he gets the credit, and the other half is going to say Trump was right. The economy was going to come back after the pandemic. So we're so divided that I don't know if the conventional wisdom works anymore, Bill.
Well, it may not. And remember that the Democrats are determined to pass a voting rights bill, which would basically nationalize all federal elections, create a federal system of elections, which is not what the Constitution calls for and not what the country really wants, and will allow, I'm sure, a substantial amount of voter fraud. You know, we look to the ballot box for our salvation, but if the ballot box is stuffed, it's not going to be our salvation at all.
That's right. Well, let's talk about a couple of other topics, Bill. It looks like President Trump, or former President Trump, won a small victory in Michigan. A judge basically said that the Secretary of State did not have the authority to make some changes in the election laws. And this is a small victory, but I think it could be a significant victory if President Trump, you know, starts winning some of these legal cases. Obviously, it's not going to change who's in the White House, but it could be bad news for President Biden if he keeps these cases keep going Trump's way, Bill.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this very thing last night. What if some developments occur in states that are perhaps on the fence politically, mm-hmm. that do show that President Trump might have come within shooting distance of winning the last election if the votes were counted honestly. What do you do in a situation like that this far into a presidential term? I'm not so sure anything would be done.
I don't know how they do it. I mean, you couldn't invalidate the election.
That's right. I think the only thing you could do would be to prosecute people who stole votes. But I don't think you can invalidate a president who's already in office. The only penalty or a means of removing him is impeachment, and you would have to prove that he personally stole the election. And then the votes clearly are not there for that. I mean, you wouldn't be able to get an impeachment vote in the House. The House is controlled by Democrats. They're not going to impeach a Democratic president. Therefore, there would be no trial in the Senate. I don't know what you do. We would be in completely new territory.
Well, I mean, there's really nothing you can do. But if there are victories like this, it would be a victory for President Trump, not in the sense that he would be reinstated president, but it would give the narrative legs, you know, to run on. And frankly, I think the best thing that could come out of all of this, you're seeing it in Georgia and you're going to see it in Texas here soon. When it goes, it's already passing the Senate here in Texas, so it goes to the House of Representatives. But I think if you see more and more states standing up saying, these are the rules and they cannot be changed under any circumstances.
Yes.
If that's what comes out of all of this, that might be great because that's really all you want. I mean, I don't think that there's enough votes in 2020, 40,000 votes, I think, decided the election in six states. You're probably not going to be able to change those 40,000 votes. It would take a lot of work to do that, I think, and I'm not sure that we have the time or the interest to do it. But if you could just persuade people that there was some wrongdoing, that's a huge victory, Bill.
Yes, yes, it is a huge victory. It's a moral victory, and it might encourage Trump to run again. But I have to tell you, my enthusiasm for Trump running again is not high, because I think that while many Republicans would want him to run again, believing he could win, there's an old saying in politics that a politician is at his most popular the day before he announces for the presidency. And then once he announces, people give a second look. And, you know, he made these speeches over the weekend that were filled with obscenities, with the old Trump personality, the chip on his shoulder, going after Republicans who don't like him. And Americans will see, if he runs again, that personality again. And I believe it's that personality that lost us the election. I don't think Biden won the election. I think Trump lost it. And I think that he's not going to change. They're going to see that again, and they think that many people will say, enough. We've gone through this before, even though we agree with his policies. I think that a political figure following Trump's philosophy would be a better candidate, and that candidate right now is Ron DeSantis of Florida, and the press is going all out to destroy him, as we saw.
Right,
in
which
the CBS
proves
interview.
That he must be the guy.
He must be the guy right now, but it's very, very early. There are other candidates. The Republican Party is filled with talent. We have plenty of talent. The Democratic Party is not filled with talent because they are all hamstrung by the need to kowtow to the political left. So they all come off as weak and indecisive. Republican Party is stronger, but I really don't think it is a good idea for Trump to run again. Again, he criticized Mike Pence. For God's sake, the man was the most loyal vice president you could have. Okay, you disagreed with him on the vote counting in the House of Representatives and the way he handled it, but enough already. And it's time to move to the future. If he would make a series of presidential-style speeches dealing with the future of the United States and leave out his personal attacks and his vulgarity, he might be able to make a comeback. But in the absence of that, I think it's a problem.
Well, you may remember that I said a couple of months ago when President Biden came in that I felt that the best thing President Trump could do would be to disappear for 6 or 9 months. Because if you disappear for 6 or 9 months, that's when people actually miss you. They don't really miss you when you keep talking. And I think that, you know, if so many issues are blowing in his direction, gasoline prices, the border. He doesn't have to talk. Everybody knows it. Other politicians are talking. So I continue to say, I don't know if he's going to run. The time will tell. But I do think it would be better for him to stop talking, just sit there and enjoy a little time off.
I agree with that.
And let the events are working on his behalf. This is a little bit like the Carter administration in the sense that, if you remember, President Ford was pretty popular by the spring of 1980 because people were comparing him to the President Carter, and he kept looking better and better against President Carter. So the same thing could happen to President Trump, we hope. One last issue, Bill, I wanted to bring up. President Biden is apparently naming a commission. Maybe they're going to put you on the commission, Bill.
Pack
the court or to look at the court. I don't know. I'm always skeptical when politicians name a commission because I think in some ways they're ducking the issue, and I think that's what he's doing here, Bill.
He probably is. Setting up a commission which is supposed to be bipartisan, but I don't know how the Republican members will be selected. Maybe he'll select them, and we'll have an Iranian-style election where the government selects the candidates, because I don't know of any respectable Republican that would want to be on that commission, but there are the never-Trump Republicans who might. I mean, they might be able to get former senators who don't like Trump to serve on the commission. It's a bad idea to begin with. The Supreme Court is just fine. 9 is a good number of justices, as Ruth Ginsburg herself said, not long before she passed away. There is no appetite in the country for packing the court, and packing the court is a terrible idea because when the Republicans, and they will at some point get back into power, they will simply unpack it. They'll just add 5 more justices of their own, and you'll have a ridiculous destruction. Something that profound should be done by constitutional amendment, not by a vote of Congress. Congress has the power to pack the court, but should not use it.
Right. Well, the point is that the rate we're going, the Supreme Court will fit in Yankee Stadium. I mean, there will be so many members of the Supreme Court, it'll become a supranational legislature. If they keep packing, because the Republicans come in, they'll put 10,000 justices. The Democrats come in, they'll put another 10. They'll need Yankee Stadium to hold a meeting. But I think you're right. I think it's a terrible idea. But once again, though, we see issues that were avoided during the campaign coming back, like immigration, like packing the court. None of these things were discussed during the campaign, or at least he was never really forced to take an opinion, a position on this during the campaign, and now it's all coming back. Bill, as we look at this week, any particular issues that you're going to be following this week? Anything that you think will be something we need to keep an eye on, Bill?
Well, clearly the situation at the border has reached the status of the major issue. The legislation up in Congress, which the president is calling an infrastructure bill. Which is not an infrastructure bill, unless you define infrastructure as everything. The bill is becoming quite controversial. There are some Democrats who have doubts about it. Most Republicans have doubts about it. But they're going to try to slam that through, which would mean, again, enormous expenditures for the United States at a time when we are so deeply in debt as a nation. The progress of the coronavirus, we have new strains of it that have appeared in the United States, but we also have a vaccination campaign that is succeeding. There is some indication from research in Israel and other places that some of the new strains may be able to defeat or overcome the virus. That would be a tragedy, but I would trust then the drug companies to come up with a booster shot that would take care of that. We're still fighting that fight, but it is one that is being fought every day. In Michigan, is showing a very sizable spike in coronavirus cases. I don't know why. I am not an expert on this, but I think it is interesting that Michigan is a progressive Democratic state, and it's showing a spike, which I'm sure they will blame on President Trump.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll blame it on Trump, even though I don't think Michigan has fully opened. So I don't know what kind of lockdown they're going to have because they're not fully open. I do want to bring up some information here that we were talking about before, and I just wanted to to close that circle, we were talking about Major League Baseball losing money. Well, apparently in 2020, because of the pandemic, they lost $3 billion. That was the total loss for Major League Baseball. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. This year, they're not all the teams are filling up the stadiums. In most places, you're getting 20 to 25%. Texas Rangers being the exception, we've opened the place, and so far, no problems. But, you know, so when you lose $3 billion and you're not able to fill your stadiums, and not exactly the moment you would make a decision like this that is simply going to turn off fans. I mean, this is the last thing you do when you need to get fans to sort of come back to the game, Bill.
That's exactly right. Now, of course, the Major League Baseball may have a solution to that, and that is to go to Congress and say, we have acted to increase voter participation, and
right.
we believe that we deserve a federal subsidy for that, and they may get it. You know, once again, write the check.
That's right. That would be a great story to talk about, Bill. One of these days, we can talk about these major league teams, asking for subsidies because they're not making any money. That would be a fun thing to watch, Bill, to say the least.
It would be fun to watch. And there is
no
shame in the Democratic Party, and they would probably say baseball is a national pastime. It provides employment to a lot of people. We don't want to see our national pastime hurt. Maybe the Republicans don't care about the flag. We do. I mean, they come up with these lines. They're just recited, and then a check will be written.
That's right. Well, that would be funny, though. That would be funny to have Major League Baseball ask for a subsidy. I wonder what the other sports would do, because the other sports aren't doing any better. The Hockey League is also having problems. The NBA, we know the story there. So I don't know. I just don't know what the commissioner was thinking. He would have been so much better off telling Stacey Abrams, who's apparently, from what we hear, the person who convinced him, he could have said, well, Ms. Abrams, we don't do politics, and do you really want me to take those jobs away from Atlanta?
Yes.
Maybe she should have said that to her. Well, Bill, have a great week, as always. Thank you for your time, and thank you so much. Keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda. We'll get together next week again.
Looking forward to it, Silvio. We always have a lot to talk about.
We sure do. We always do have a lot to talk about. Have a wonderful day, Bill, and enjoy your week.
Same to you, Silvio.
Thank you so much. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Baseball lost $3 billion in 2020. That's a lot of money. I had no idea that it was that much. So anyway, something to think about. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.